Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome everybody here to the Mark Steiner Show and to Sound Bites, our weekly look at our food, farming, and the environment. You hear every week here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. Today's show is all about our children. We're going to be talking about new research that shows food allergies have doubled among black children. Is it genetic or environmental? We talk about those issues and their complexity with Dr. Corinne Keat, who's one of the authors of those reports. And we'll be talking with Chef Ann Cooper, the renegade lunch lady, and with Amy Calafa, who produced the film Two Angry Moms and wrote the book Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. But first, I sat down with Michael J. Wilson, who's executive director of Maryland Hunger Solutions, to talk about Maryland Day and the work school advocates will be doing around school breakfast on Tuesday, March 25th. For some of you, that'll be today, and for others, that'll have been yesterday. But the work goes beyond Maryland Day, and here's Michael J. Wilson. All across Maryland on Tuesday, March the 25th.
That's correct, Maryland Day.
All of Maryland will hear this.
Only louder.
The crunch of an apple.
That's exactly right. So we're having Hear the Crunch Maryland tomorrow on Maryland Day. People probably didn't realize that it was Maryland Day or have an idea how to celebrate Maryland Day. And we thought it would be important if we could once again focus and emphasize the importance of starting the day with a healthy, nutritious breakfast, especially for kids, especially for kids. And so we've got school systems around the state who signed up for this. We've got offices. We've got government offices and private sector offices and Head Start offices and folks who are going to be crunching an apple on Tuesday. Day, for Hear the Crunch Maryland.
No, tell me, sorry, this apple I'm eating is really good.
Good.
And it is organic.
Excellent.
It's a rainier apple, which is a lovely thing.
There you go.
So why?
Why?
I mean, what does it really mean to crunch an apple? I mean,
right.
Symbolically it sounds lovely, but what are we symbolizing
right.
here?
Right. So the substance of this is very important because kids eat what we feed them.
Right.
And kids learn from us about what's an important breakfast. And the other thing we know is that having breakfast in the school, studies have shown breakfast in the school is generally healthier and more nutritious than breakfast served at home because they have more requirements in terms of dairy and fruit and whole grains. So kids getting a healthy, nutritious breakfast at school is good for us, not just health-wise, but it's also good for us academically because kids who are hungry can't learn.
So, I mean, is there something that's actually happening in Maryland that is threatening that, or are you doing this for another reason?
So there's nothing that's threatening that, but we're doing it, A, to emphasize the importance of breakfast, which is important, and B, for schools and school systems which don't do breakfast on a regular basis, it's an opportunity for them to see the importance and to do it on this occasion and to add that to their regular routine.
I was reading an article about San Francisco.
Okay.
And what they have found is that there are numerous kids that do not get the free breakfast or the breakfast in the morning the school serves because the bus is late or they rather chat outside with their friends rather than go in school and have something to eat.
Right.
So what they've done is they instituted brunch. So when kids go out to recess, first thing they sit down at a picnic table and they're given a box of something to eat and show that everybody actually has something to eat. Some kids don't like to eat in the morning.
That's right. So there are numerous, as we call them in the business, innovative models to handle all of those situations. There's something called second chance breakfast that you can do. Breakfast in the classroom is better than having breakfast before school because then you don't isolate some kids who get there early to have breakfast, and you have breakfast in the classroom is incorporated as part of the day. There's also something called grab-and-go breakfast so that when kids walk in, depending on how the school sets it up, you grab the breakfast and you take it right with you to the classroom. There's no one single model that works for every kid, but the goal is that if we can have innovative models and use flexibility, mm-hmm. we can provide kids for breakfast. But the other part of that you said is also right. So in Maryland, about 55% of the kids who are eligible for free and reduced lunch are getting breakfast. So it's great that that many of them are getting it, but it's a problem that 45% of them are not.
Because they don't make it there in time to eat it?
For a variety of reasons, either because the school hasn't provided it, because the school doesn't publicize the breakfast that they're having, because the kids don't know about it. For a lot of different reasons, there are barriers there. And sometimes those are funding. So we're working on funding issues as well.
So how does school breakfast, or does it, like vary across the state of Maryland? I mean, are the realities in Baltimore that are different compared to, let's say, the Eastern Shore or Southern Maryland or Western Maryland or the D.C. region?
So there are certain requirements that you have to meet because of USDA guidelines. So one of the good things that's going to happen next year is that there can be only whole grains, and it's got to be at least a full portion of fruit at every breakfast. And fruit does not mean juice. And only milk, no flavored milks. So they're going to increase the requirements, not just statewide, but nationally because of what USDA has done. But school systems are run, as we all know, by county or by the city.
Right.
And so they're a little...
Local jurisdictions.
Absolutely. Right. That's exactly right. So some of them are a little bit different here and there. And so, you know, I actually have staff that's going to be in Prince George's County tomorrow and some in Washington County and some in Howard County. We're going to be in lots of different places. But we're trying to emphasize not the differences, but the universality of what's important about breakfast. And so it's often true that when you go to a certain school or a certain school district, they say, oh, we're different. We're a little bit different here, and here's why. And so we have to acknowledge that there are differences, but the requirements for the kids and the needs of the kids are pretty universal in terms of behavior. We can provide a breakfast for them.
So the kids don't get pastries, chocolate milk, that's off the menu now?
They may get pastries and chocolate milk today. They may get pastries and chocolate milk in June, but next year, USDA requirements are going to be upgraded. And so they have to have at least whole milk. It's not going to be flavored milk. They're going to have a full serving of fruit at every breakfast, and they're going to have only whole grains. So if it's a whole grain pastry, maybe that's what they can do. And this is another reason why breakfasts in schools, believe it or not, by and large, are healthier than the breakfasts they get at home, because kids at home don't always have those same requirements.
What do you say in response to people who are saying, well, come on, are we not taking the role of parenting away from parents? And this is, why should this be... They're saying that we can feed your children better than you can feed them. Some people can think that's kind of paternalistic.
I understand. And as a parent who had kids go through the Montgomery County school system, I can tell you my son, who we fed breakfast at home, loved going to school and eating breakfast with his classmates. There's a social activity there that's also very well documented. In addition, it's not that we're taking it away from parents. Parents who want to provide breakfast for their kids are going to do so. And kids who aren't hungry aren't going to come in and say, oh, I want another breakfast. But kids often are going to have breakfast, and they want to be with their classmates. And we can't forget the kids whose parents can't give them breakfast, either because they can't afford it or because they're stretched in their budget or because they're stretched in time and they're worried about being able to provide breakfast. And so for all of those kids, especially for our neighbors and for our friends throughout the state, we want to make sure they also have access to a healthy breakfast.
And I think one of the realities is that we should talk about for a minute is just food and learning and school and the relationship between those aspects of our existence. I mean, the San Francisco article that I was reading was talking about how all kids don't like to have breakfast. All kids don't eat breakfast, which is why they have the later in the morning program for kids to eat.
Right.
But that when you're hungry, you're grumpy, as one principal said. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that eating healthy food has a direct relationship to a kid's behavior and their learning inside the school.
Absolutely. So the simplest way to say this, kids who are hungry can't learn. But the truth is there have been documented evidence of when you provide breakfast in the school, that academic achievement goes up. People test better. It's documented. In addition, serving breakfast in a school doesn't solve all the behavioral problems, but it solves some behavioral and social problems for kids who are acting out because they're hungry. In addition, we also know that serving breakfast in a school actually helps deal with tardiness and absenteeism. You know, you may feel however you feel about school, but if you know you're going to get breakfast.
And I think it's reality in some places in Western Maryland, the Eastern Shore, Baltimore City, that the breakfast and lunches kids get in these schools, and people don't realize this, I think, are sometimes the only meal these kids get.
That's correct. That's exactly right.
In school.
That's exactly right. And so we want to make sure they're healthy breakfasts, but we want to make sure that we provide this to as many of those kids as possible.
So today or yesterday, depending on when you hear this program,
right,
the day being the 25th, people will hear.
That's correct. We've had more than 100 and as of this morning, 130,000 different individuals and folks sign up, you know, and we'll get more today. People are still coming in. Absolutely. in Baltimore City and all the senior centers on Hear the Crunch Day, they're going to serve apples. They're going to have apples on the menu in school systems all across the state because we worked with the Maryland State Department of Education to help get this out early. We've had a lot of support from private sector. Wegmans is providing apples in Howard County. Giant gave us some nice gift certificate to help supply apples to other places. I mean, apples are, for lack of a better term, a great symbol for what we want to have our kids have for breakfast.
So finally, Michael J. Wilson, so Tuesday, March 25th, Maryland Day, people will be crunching these apples symbolically to talk about the food for our children. But how can people get more involved and know more about this beyond that?
They can either call our office, area code 410-528-0021, or they can go online, www.MarylandHungerSolutions.org. You know, we've had a lot of support all around, bipartisan support from the legislature, from members of Congress. Governor O'Malley's given us a quote. Former Baltimorean Nancy Pelosi gave us a quote in support of this. So we're really proud to have all that support. And it's not just because it's nice and it's for kids. It's also it's important because as we can set kids on the right path for what's a healthy breakfast, it's going to mean something for them academically and it's going to mean something for their lifetimes.
Michael Wilson, director of the Maryland Hunger Solutions. Always good to see you. Thank you so much for coming to our studios once again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now we're about to talk to Dr. Corinne Keat. Dr. Corinne Keat is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins Health Center. She specializes in allergies and immunology. And she was author of a study published in the March issue of Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology called Temporal Trends and Racial Ethnic Disparity in the Self-Reported Pediatric Food Allergy in the United States. And Dr. Corinne Keat, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And sound bites are other looking at food in the food system. This is really fascinating to me. I mean, so there have been a couple of studies. There was studies done in, I guess, 2011 that were similar but different than this one, what I was reading. Why don't you just describe what you discovered? Because I was really kind of taken aback when I first read it.
Yeah, so this is just to give you a little bit of background, this study is what's called a meta-analysis where we're trying to synthesize data from the literature, where we comb through the literature and find studies that have been done to look at prevalence of food allergy. And we were particularly interested in whether food allergy had changed over time. And then, like you said, whether there were might be differences in certain subgroups in the temporal trends. And so we found studies that had mostly been done by the CDC. Some of them had not been published, but many of them had been. And we found that sort of similar to what a lot of people perceive, that there has been an increase, at least I should say all these studies were by asking people if they had food allergy. So they weren't going in and testing whether people really had food allergy, but there has been this increase in people's perception that they have food allergy over time. And what we found that was a little bit more surprising was that when we broke it down by racial ethnic group, that this increase was a lot higher among the African-American children than it was among the Caucasian and Hispanic children. And we didn't have as much. Most of the data wasn't broken down into other ethnic or racial groups. And we're still trying to figure out a couple of things about that. One, is this real increases in time? And are these ethnic differences real? Or is this changes in diagnosis or perception of food allergy over time? And then the second one, it would be reasons why there might be these ethnic differences and why they've been changed.
Yeah, I was curious about some things because, you know, when you – the reason I said it was counterintuitive early on is only because when you see kind of things on the news about children with food allergies, peanuts, that invariably the kids you see on the news are white.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
right?
That may be that, you know, it has to do with sort of who ends up the sort of face of food allergy.
Oh, no question about it. That's why I was just
right. Right. And, you know, there's not been very, very much literature devoted to this. There was one study that found that among children with food allergy that African-American children were less likely to be prescribed EpiPens in schools than white children. So there may be some ethnic disparities in treatment of food allergy between different groups. And, you know, in general, for other allergic diseases like asthma, we do know that there are actually quite wide ethnic disparities, that African-American children are more affected. It's not clear how much those differences, you know, extend to other to food allergy, for, because we haven't had as much data about that. But I think that you're right in that it's thought to be sort of a disease of affluent people.
Right, right.
And you often see that, and we're not sure that that's true.
I think what you said is probably very correct, knowing the stats in other areas, that African-American kids and other kids of color in this country, and poor kids in general, are not treated the same. I mean,
right.
are given the same
right.
treatments. And so we're always seeing it from an affluent perspective and not from the perspective of all children.
Right.
What do you know from this? What do we know from this? About what are the questions that, well, A, I mean, what is it you discovered that was kind of shocking in all of this in terms of what, and what do we not know that we need to know?
So I think there's, you know, what we did discover was that, you know, if we go back 10 or 15, 20 years, it looked like at that time, most studies, African-American children were reporting food allergy at rates lower than their white counterparts. But now they seem to be reporting rates higher. So that what that means is that over time, you know, that their increase has been higher. There, I think, like I said, there's a number of things that need to be just figured out. So one, we, you know, all of this data is about self-report, as I mentioned. And so it's hard in large studies to really get down to whether people really have reactions when they're given food. But we know that many people who think they have food allergies don't actually have food allergies. Because it can be confusing to interpret what's a food allergy and what's not. So one of the things that we want to do is to look at biomarkers of food allergy to see whether those have changed over time and whether we see the same ethnic differences over time that we're seeing with self-reported data. And then I think if we are seeing the same changes in biomarkers over time for food allergy, the question then is there some sort of environmental factor that's affecting different groups differently, and if so, you know, what is that environmental factor? So these are that's the 5 to 10 year plan.
Because what you found is, and this is, let me see if I have this correct from some of the synopsis I read, that food allergies increased among black children at the rate of 2.1% every 10 years, while they increased at a rate of 1.2% each decade for Hispanics and 1% for every 10 years among white children. So,
right.
So that's
those are,
that's
yeah.
pretty glaring in some ways. So I was
yes. You know, none of these numbers are, it is glaring. It's not, these. In terms of the estimates, it's a little bit hard to tell exactly what the prevalence of food allergy is and exactly how it's been changing. But when we do look at these trends over time, that was what we found, that it was about a double the absolute percentage increase over time.
And so, I mean, and there was something, was it in your report or the other report that talked about the lack of vitamin D might contribute to this?
That was not the study.
That was the other study. That,
but right. there has been some thought that vitamin D might play a role, and that could explain some ethnic differences in that people with darker skin have a harder time absorbing vitamin D, or not absorbing vitamin D, but converting vitamin D in the skin from sunlight than do people with lighter skin. There's so that vitamin D could potentially play a role. There's been quite a number of studies about vitamin D and allergy, and they've shown conflicting results. So that's an area that people are really actively investigating right now, what the potential role of vitamin D deficiency in allergic disease might be. But it's still an open question.
So I'm curious. Let's talk about a bit about what you can extrapolate from this and what you need to know. It sounds, I mean, well, let me ask that question first, and I'll do a follow-up.
Yeah. So what can extrapolate? So I think, you know, that the ethnic disparities in food allergy have not been as noted as they have for other allergic diseases, but that I think there should be more attention to those now, and to make sure that we are adequately treating food allergies no matter who is presenting with them. So that's sort of the clinical implications. In terms of the research implications, I think if this is substantiated, we, you know, could suggest other ways, other things to look into in terms of not just vitamin D, but other environmental differences that there might be, as well as other genetic differences that there might be that might have different susceptibility to environmental changes.
Well, that's what I was wondering. One of the things I was thinking about reading this study that was that, and other programs we have done before about other clinical studies around other health issues,
mm-hmm.
is that you know, those of us of a certain age will say this, and you've probably heard this ad nauseum, but when I was a kid, we didn't have, the peanut allergies. I mean, it was almost unheard of. I mean, you didn't find it in your schools. As a child, I don't remember anybody at all like that in my elementary school, as we ate lunch together. So, what is it about? Are there environmental factors that we need to start investigating? It seems a lot of our research goes to genetics, but very little to the environment.
Right.
Or, you know, what factors might be causing this growth from this and any other kind of disorders?
So I think your question is a really good one, and these changes that we see over time are clearly not just due to genetics, because genetics don't change over the course of decades. But one area that I'm interested in is how the genetics interact with the environment. And we have some evidence from other allergic diseases that different people of different genetic backgrounds might have different effects of the environment. And understanding how exactly the environment and genetics interact might can help us really understand the mechanisms of the environmental factors that might be at play. And so I think it could be a fruitful area of research. I don't have a clear theory, though, for what's happening
mm-hmm.
here.
So where do you take this next? I mean, what is this clearly is there has to be the next series of investigations you're going to do. What will you be doing next for this?
So my next planned study is, like I said, to look at biomarkers of allergy using one of the surveys that we included in the study, a large national survey to look at the serum that's been frozen for the past 2 decades. Compare the levels of an allergic biomarker to the levels that have been measured in the same survey more recently, to see whether or what, how much of this is due to diagnosis of allergic disease and how much of this is due to actually changes, the biologic changes. And so we're interested in looking at whether those there are ethnic differences in these biomarkers that have changed over time as well.
So this is really fascinating. I think it's a really important study because it goes in some ways the idea of actually looking at the interactive relationship between genes, the environment, and what may be causing these food allergies to be so prevalent among young African American children. I mean, I think it's a very important piece to do. Do you have any sense of what this might mean in terms of treatment?
I think treatment is a whole other question,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot of interesting things going on right now for food allergy. I don't think that these data give a clear answer about treatment, although many of the treatments that are currently being developed are likely going to be pretty expensive and difficult to implement. And I think ultimately, we need to take into account the demographics and epidemiology of food allergy when we're ultimately we need to have a sort of easily implemented treatment. But I don't know how this would have exact or what the exact implications will be for treatment.
Well, this is a really important piece of work, and I appreciate you taking time. We've been talking to Dr. Corinne Keat, and the study is in the March issue of the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. They looked at 450,000 children and showing food allergies increase among African-American children more than others, and really investigating why is what she's doing now. She's assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, where she specializes in allergies and immunology. And you know, Dr. Corinne Keat, thank you so much for taking your time. It's been great to have you on the air with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We have to take a very brief break, but when we return, we'll be discussing the lunches our young people eat in school and hear a kid-friendly recipe that's friendly for all of us for oven-fried chicken. You definitely don't want to miss that. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Soundbites right here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. We are going to talk with two women who are coming to Washington College, to Chestertown later this week, and we'll be telling you about that in a moment as well in our continuing conversations with the folks who are coming for these conversations at the Locavore Lit Festival, which is coming up. We're about to talk with Amy Califa, who for over 25 years, Amy has been producing award-winning films, television programs, magazine articles in the field of health education. She's holds a lectureship at the Yale University School of Medicine and Psychiatry for her work in the field of health communication. She has a holistic health and nutrition counselor and a Lyme disease consultant. And she made this incredible documentary called Two Angry Moms, and the author of the book Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. And Chef Ann Cooper is with us, and you can see her on TEDx. She's the Renegade Lunch Lady. She's a partner in Lunch Lessons LLC, Director of Nutrition Services for the Boulder Valley School District, and founder of the Food Family Farming Foundation, The Lunchbox, and Let's Move the Salad Bars to Schools. Her most recent book is Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children. And Chef Ann Cooper and Amy Califa, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you.
So, well, it took a long time to get those introductions done, but we're done. So, Amy, let me start with you. This idea of this film, the idea that this issue had to be brought to the public in a major national way. Talk a bit about what was behind this film first and your motivation for pushing it.
Sure. Well, what was behind the film was that, you know, I had long had an interest in environment and food and the intersection of, you know, how this impacted human health in general. And, of course, hearing the CDC's alarming statistics, you know, coming out right around 2005, 2006 about the childhood obesity crisis, and they are the ones that said this will be the first generation in American history to live shorter lives than their parents. I was alarmed on, you know, on a personal level, then of course on a general level, and I'm a filmmaker, and I kind of felt like somebody should do something about this, and then I actually was sent to meet Ann Cooper for a segment. I was working for Martha Stewart. And when I met Ann and learned about her work, at the time she was in Eastern Long Island at a private school, and I saw the phenomenal job she was doing with lunch there, I thought, well, geez, why can't we do this or something close to this at every school across the country? It would go a long way to really impacting children's health and educating them. And so I decided there and then to make a documentary about the issue, as I thought that would be the best way to reach the most people, was by setting it in schools and seeing what we could do to advocate for better food in schools. So I told Ann I'd be back, and by the time I caught up to her again, she was already the head lunch lady in Berkeley, California, and that became part of my film.
And but if you were also pushed in some ways by seeing what happened in your own child's school.
Yes.
Right? That,
so when I decided to make the film, I went to my daughter's middle school just to see how the lunch program worked, because I think like most parents, I wasn't paying a lot of attention. And I thought I was doing a pretty good job sending her to school with a healthy packed lunch. And when I went in to film at her school, they have this computerized lunch program, which a lot of have now, where you can put money on account and then, you know, the child can pick what they want for lunch. So I asked if they would do a printout of what my daughter had chosen. And even though she was taking her lunch as a packed lunch most days, she had money on account there in case she forgot lunch or wanted something else. And I was literally shocked when I saw what came out of that computer readout. She was on a daily basis buying Pop-Tarts and Rice Krispie treats and Snapple drinks and basically a ton of junk food that I had no idea was even available for sale in the school cafeteria. And I really felt that they were undermining the efforts that we were trying to do at home to, you know, really teach our daughter about food and to eat a healthy meal at lunchtime. I was shocked.
So, and one of the things that this occurred to me, reading everything you've written and both of you have written and watching on TEDx and the film and having interviewed Tony Gerassi, who was the head of the school system's food in Baltimore for a while, now moving on to Memphis, it strikes me, Ann Cooper, is how difficult this is. I mean, you'd think it'd be relatively easy to talk about how to have healthier food in our cafeterias for our children or for the breakfast and lunch programs. But this is a combination of how we buy our food and where it comes from and who has what contracts to supply foods with lots of food to people not wanting people to tell them what they should be doing or what kids should eat. This is not an easy a subject as one would think.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I often say it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, everyone believes that they know what's best for their kids. Everyone has food memories. Everyone has comfort food. And when you go in and say, this is not what you should be feeding your kids, this is not what we should be feeding your kids, that often has parents up in arms. I mean, there are certainly parents like Amy and lots of parents all across the country that really care about what we feed our kids and want our kids to be healthy. But there is actually an equal, if not a majority, of parents who think they know better for what they feed their kids in the household from many reasons, and some of it might be financial, is really different than what we might want to feed them in school. So the pushback from parents can be tremendous. The pushback from administrators and teachers can be really tremendous. And for the kids, I mean, you know, big business spends $17 to $20 billion a year marketing non-nutrient foods to kids. So, you know, when I come in and say eat broccoli, you know, that doesn't necessarily go over. So we have a generation.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we have a generation of kids that have grown up on chicken nuggets and hot Cheetos. And, you know, so we really have a struggle changing school food. It's not easy.
I mean, we've seen the struggle from the ground up in Baltimore and in Memphis and many other cities and what's going on in America. So there is a bubbling up happening. Talk a bit about this bubbling up and why you think this is a critical issue.
Well, it's critical because, first of all, that, you know, our environment, the whole environment that our children are being raised in is getting more and more toxic. And there aren't a lot of things that we as parents can control in our kids' environment. And so food is one of them, I think. It, you know, we feel like at home, at least, we can have some control over what kids are eating. And as Ann said, there's this huge multi-billion-dollar industry that's marketing all this junk to to our kids. And we see what's happening, especially in the cities. You see how unhealthy kids are, and the obesity crisis is a visual. But what I see, you know, as a mother, is a lot of my kids' friends have all kinds of behavioral issues, learning issues that I don't remember anybody having growing up. So the environment has to be a factor in what's causing it. And one way that we can have an impact is by looking at what kids are eating, and that really means examining the entire food system. And because school food is something that almost every child in America is exposed to, I think that's why the movement has become so strong and so important, because it is one way that we can push back, that we can have that kind of control and look and see, well, how can we create a new food system? And that's why what Anne's work was so fascinating to me, because she was really looking at the food system and trying to change it and fix it from the ground up. And that's the core of this effort. So I'm kind of on the advocacy side of, you know, reaching out to other parents and trying to help them understand why this is an important issue, and that it's much better if we do it from the side of schools, where the kids can then take that learning home. Because very often the food industry is pointing the fingers right back at the parents, saying, well, you guys are the bad guys because you're feeding the junk food, and that's what kids want because you feed it to them. So we're trying to change that whole conversation and get kids to understand and learn about food and have that connection to their food, and then bring that home to their parents as well.
So, I mean, and Amy, I guess that connection I've seen you make in other ways and things you've written, and also in your TEDx talk that I saw you give. I'm sorry, I didn't mean Amy, I mean Anne. It's so difficult to put your hands around this in some ways, because and you both have written about this, we are so disconnected from our food and the realities of how we get it, whether it's meat or vegetables or what it is we're eating, and that it's so pervasive in terms of the power of huge food business and what they bring to us to counter that. It does start at the school level, but that's what makes it also difficult, but that's what makes it even more important to do.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, building on what Amy said, is we have a broken food system, and we can use school food as a lever. So there are 5.4 billion lunches a year served in America in school food, and another 2.5-3 billion breakfasts. So when you think about how many times we touch kids, and in really high poverty schools, not only that, but we feed them snack and dinner. So we have between a third and sometimes as much as 100% of the nutrition that a child gets for the 180 or 184 days of the school year happens in school. And so that can be a lever to make change. But, you know, between the lobbying groups like the Dairy Council and the National Cattlemen's Association and Congress and the Frozen Food Association and the Tomato Association, I mean, there's so much lobbyists putting pressure on the system to feed kids in a way that specifically lines their pocket, that the whole system is broken. I mean, if nobody cared about anything except healthy food, this wouldn't be a problem. If nobody cared about anything except the health of our children, this wouldn't be a problem. But we are a very profit-motivated society, and there's a lot of lobbying, and there's a lot of politics, and it ends up with unhealthy food on a lot of our kids' plates.
So, Amy, talk a bit about where you found in your film things going right. Where are things moving in directions that gave you some hope and give us all inspiration?
Well, that was really, really important for me. I had seen a lot of documentaries in the recent past when I made the film that were just so depressing, and you'd walk out of there thinking, oh, my gosh, the world is a horrible place and there's nothing I can do.
Right, right.
So I really wanted to find examples. And at the time, you know, the film came out in 2008, so I was filming it during the school year 2006-07. I did have a hard time finding really great examples, but I found a number of them, and being one of them in Berkeley. Also, in Riverside, California, Rodney Taylor has done an incredible job just working in his district to get a farmer's market salad bar there. So instead of getting a salad bar out of the food that had been trucked for miles and miles away, even living in California, he reached out to the local farmers and put in a salad bar, and he was a skeptic. It was really parents who forced him to do it, I could say. When he saw how much the kids enjoyed it and how successful it was, and then also the adult staff at the school started buying lunch there, so he was able to increase a you know, those two programs were in California, so me as a skeptic, I thought, well, people are going to watch this film and say, yeah, well, that's easy, it's California. So I did travel to other parts of the country and eventually found Tony Gerace in New Hampshire is where he was at that time.
Right.
And he had really created a very innovative program there by starting with sports nutrition and feeding his hockey and baseball team members what he called, you know, a sports nutrition meal, which was really just a healthy, balanced meal made from well-sourced ingredients. When those teams went from being state underdogs to state champions over the course of that school year, it was really a great marketing thing, and it made other kids and other families want to eat what those kids were eating. So he was able to institute a lot of changes in his cafeteria that was then driven by the kids themselves, and they started creating healthier menus. So I thought that was a really great example, and there are a number of others in the film. And then by the time I wrote the book, which was several years later, I found many, many, many more in small school districts and in large city schools as well. So it's different models in different places.
So how do you see both of you, and with this kind of coming together nationally? You'll both be here in Maryland on the Eastern Shore, and things have been bubbling up here in Maryland, bubbling up in Baltimore and across the state. And I wonder how you see this, taking up, first of all, I'll go to Anne and then go to Amy. How do you see this nationally kind of bubbling up, both of you as and connecting with people across America? I mean, is that happening?
You know, I really think that, I mean, I started 15 years ago in a Amy Center in a small private school, and 15 years ago, no one was talking about school food. And fast forward today, we have a first lady with the White House Garden, and being a cheerleader and an advocate brought this into our home. We've had Jamie Oliver and a reality TV show that brought it into our home. The Obama's cabinet, you know, Secretary of Education and Secretary of Agriculture, both have made school food and healthy kids a priority. I mean, I've heard Arne Duncan say that if we want to close the achievement gap, we have to close the nutrition gap. We've had agriculture, the Secretary of Agriculture, actually change school food with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. So I think we are seeing positive changes all across the country. We still see pushback, and we still have plenty of schools serving prepackaged food or serving highly processed food. But I believe we really are at a place where people understand that we have to change what we feed our kids and are really taking baby steps, and some of them giant steps, but at least taking baby steps to make this a reality.
I totally agree with Anne that, you know, in the past 10 years or so, we have created a movement. And it's exciting because there have been changes, and it's, of course, really encouraging for those of us who've been involved in it to see that things are changing. But I also worry that that can breed complacency because we have had some federal changes, and then also in local wellness policies there have been changes made. And I fear that people are going to think, okay, that problem's solved, and we'll just walk away and move on to the next. And it's really far from a solved problem. Things have improved, but I think it's essential for every parent, every educator, and every school food service worker to really be involved on this on an ongoing basis and to be vigilant about what kind of ingredients are in the menus, and, you know, really looking at where the food is coming from and constantly checking on that. So people have to be involved as an education issue, just like we may get new textbooks in our schools, but that doesn't mean you're not constantly looking for new curriculum and trying to, you know, create the latest and greatest kind of program. That this really has to be seen as an ongoing educational issue that everybody, and especially parents, have to be involved in.
I absolutely agree with Amy. And I think that, you know, my next big thing and the thing I think we really need to do if we're going to solve this is make food literacy, home ec for the 22nd century, food literacy, as part of the academic curriculum in every school. We have to make food literacy part of the educational paradigm, and we really need to teach our kids where our food comes from and why it's important.
No, I agree. It seems to me, I'd like to get your thoughts on this, both of you, that because it seems to be a convergence here. On the one hand, and what you were talking about creating a notion of food literacy and teaching people where our food comes from and how to prepare it and how to grow it. And I was even thinking about the story that Amy wrote in Huffington Post a bit back about – her daughter and the farm you all used to own, and kind of coming to grips with even slaughtering animals if you're going to eat meat, and what that means, and that we're so distant from all of it. And the other part of it is, part of the convergence for me, is that when Tony Gerassi, one of the things he said in this program was, several years back, we just took the state of Maryland. The school systems collectively spend in the state of Maryland about $1 billion a year on food, $1 billion a year. If you thought about what the school systems in this country spend on food, that kind of leverage, that political, the kind of both fiscal and political will that could be leveraged with that kind of money, and even though you're going to be, as Tony was up against, the old procurement people who only want to do things their way, with all the Ciscos of the world, these two things meeting together really could be bringing us to a new place.
Yes, I think that's really the crux of changing the system is, you know, working on the local level to change the larger system. In a large district like Baltimore, despite all the difficulty Tony had, that is a huge amount of buying power. And one of the things that I'm excited about now is that, you know, I live in Connecticut. After making the movie and writing the book, I said, well, I've got to be active in my own local district. And we're seeing that the federal government has farm to school grant money available. I'm working with my own school district right now to apply for funding for some of those farm to school grants so that rather than purchasing from those giant purveyors, we can start contracting with local farmers and both consortiums of local farmers, even in a state like Connecticut, where we definitely have a local produce deficit. The demand is greater than the supply, but I'm working with a farm in my town on town-owned land. They can grow produce specifically for the school, and we've done the same thing in the city of Bridgeport, which is a city a lot like Baltimore with, you know, a really poor population, and we've put in a 2-acre urban farm there, which is supplying the schools with food. And this is not the whole solution, but it's a really great piece of it because this is also an opportunity for the kids to come and work on these farms and understand that this food actually tastes better because it's coming out of the ground right near them, and it has the flavor of where they live. And so that's an exciting connection that's being made on a local level, and it is impacting everywhere.
So I want to thank you both, Chef Ann Cooper and Amy Khalafa, for joining us. Two Angry Moms is the film that Amy made. The book is Lunch Wars, How to Start a School Food Revolution and Win the Battle for Our Children's Health. Chef Ann Cooper, the Renegade Lunch Lady, her most recent book is Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children. They're both coming here to Maryland. Chef Ann and Amy Khalafa will be at Washington College in Chestertown later this week. Chef Ann will be delivering the keynote address at the 2014 Locavore Literature Festival on Friday, March the 28th. At the Hotchkiss Recital Hall, and Amy will be at Washington College on Saturday, March the 29th at 1 p.m. at the Emanuel Church. You can get more information by visiting washcoll.edu and click on News and Events. All the information will also be on our website at steinershow.org to find out how to meet these two women, hear what they have to say, enter into a dialogue, and begin to take control of your child's food at school and how we can change the course of how the health of our country lives with our children. And thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Well, now for our Soundbites recipe. We're lucky that Chef Ann Cooper, the Renegade Lunch Lady, is staying with us. Of course, her book, Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children, is going to give us our recipe of the week.
Everyone loves fried chicken, but it's not exactly healthy. So we worked really hard to come up with an oven-fried chicken. There's no frying involved. In fact, there's no oil involved. And what we do is we take bone-in chicken. Thighs work really well, but any piece of chicken that you like, but bone-in, skin-on. And we take that chicken and we actually soak it in buttermilk overnight. And this tenderizes it and really makes sure you can have a really moist chicken. And then we take flour and paprika, salt, pepper, and a little bit of chili powder, some kind of spice you like, and we mix it all together. We take the chicken out of the buttermilk, let it drain a little bit, and put it in the flour. We dip it back in the buttermilk one more time, back in the flour, And then we put it on a pan and let it rest in the refrigerator for a couple of hours, as long as overnight. And then the next day, you put it in an oven at 375 degrees and roast it. And it becomes crispy, and it really has this great texture, crispy skin, really yummy chicken. And it's just really easy, really simple, and pretty healthy.
Wow, I've never tried that. I mean, I love fried chicken. I don't make it anymore. I'm a big baked chicken guy, but this is interesting. So I can have my fried chicken back?
You can have your fried chicken and eat it too. Yes.
That's wild. This is so, and it really is crispy. And I'm sure when you were younger, before you got to this world you are now, you ate fried chicken.
Of course, and you know it's something that everybody loves. But you know, there's so much oil in it and so much fat that if you can do something similar with buttermilk instead of frying oil, you get a really great product that's pretty healthy.
Wow. I'm trying this. So what would you make with it?
It really depends. Sometimes we serve it with in the spring or early fall. We might serve it with potato salad. We also might serve it with some kind of fresh vegetable or sweet potato fries or
sweet potato fries, which you can also make. You can bake them too.
Absolutely. We just cut them and bake them with a little oil and salt and pepper.
Sweet potato fries, that sounds right. Sweet potato fries and fried chicken.
Perfect.
That's great. You don't have a cookbook, do you? Or do you?
In my book, Lunch Lessons, there's a lot of recipes, all kid-tested, and all recipes you could use in school. And there's a version of the oven-fried chicken in Lunch Lessons.
Oh, well, good. Well, you can get Lunch Lessons, Changing the Way We Feed Our Children by the Renegade Lunch Lady, Ann Cooper. Of course, we'll be here this Friday night in Chestertown at Washington College, speaking at the 2014 Local 4 Lit Festival at Hotchkins Recital Hall. And go to washcall.edu or our website, see how to get there. And this sounds really delicious, and this sounds just scrumptious. Chef Ann Cooper, thank you so much for this recipe, and you gave me something new to cook since I am the house chef.
All right. Well, my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing everyone over the weekend.
Take care. Travel easy. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL, 90.7 FM, and WSCL, 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.